You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada, because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
According to writings by the founder of the modern Olympic Games, Pierre de Coubertin, sport and colonialism were logical companions. He called sports a vigorous instrument in the disciplining of colonized people and viewed it as a calming force in the colonies. The Olympics had the ability to bring together disparate colonial subjects under one flag, all in the name of friendly competition. Olympism, as a philosophy, spoke in truisms of equity, anti-discrimination, mutual recognition and respect, tolerance and solidarity. In reality, marginalized groups, especially indigenous peoples, have long faced displacement, poverty, and even murder in the name of the Olympic Games. The Olympics have been hosted in Canada a total of three times: the 1976 Summer Olympics in Montreal, the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary, and the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. Each one faced opposition from local Indigenous people and anti-Olympics organizers. The 1976 Summer Olympics in Montreal were criticized for a lack of consultation and the spectacular display of Indigenous people in the closing ceremony, at a time when Canadian Indigenous and government relations were operating under heightened tensions. The Montreal Olympic Games closing ceremony employed Indigenous symbolism without consultation with local First Nations. Hundreds of performers were enlisted to perform a tribal dance that was choreographed by a non-Indigenous choreographer to a musical score created by a non-Indigenous composer. Only 200 of the 450 performers were Indigenous, with the other 250 being non-Indigenous people costumed and painted in red face. This particularly problematic approach to include Indigenous participation is what became a model for future Canadian Olympic Games. The 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary reflected some lessons learned from criticism of the 1976 Games, but according to critics, they still perpetuated legacies of erasure, cultural and land theft, and appropriation committed by past games and Canadian governmental bodies. There were significant protests from Indigenous people against the use and appropriation of Indigenous imagery. This imagery included Indigenous sounds, sights, and images in a massive teepee in the opening ceremony, and medals depicting winter sporting equipment protruding from a ceremonial headdress. The 1988 Winter Games were also the subject of an international boycott called by the Lubicon Lake Indian Nation, a small community in northern Alberta. Their reason centered around what they considered the illegal sale of their unceded lands to oil companies. While corporations extracted resources from their land, the Lubicon Cree were experiencing a 93% decline in their annual trapping income, high rates of alcoholism, a tuberculosis crisis, and malnourishment in the community. The Lubicon Cree focused their boycott on a specific Olympic event, the Spirit Sings exhibit at the Glenbow Museum, part of the official cultural programming of the Games. They protested this exhibit on several grounds, including that almost half of its funding came from Shell Oil Canada, the very company drilling for oil on their unceded land. The exhibit consisted of Indigenous Canadian artifacts, art and objects gathered from collections around the world. Of this, Lubicon Chief Bernard Omignac said, the irony of using a display of North American Indian artifacts to attract people to the Winter Olympics being organized by interests who are still actively seeking to destroy Indian people seems painfully obvious. In addition to the boycott of the Spirit Sings, the Torch Relay Run was targeted by protesters for its sponsorship by Petro-Canada, which was invading Indigenous territories, including Lubicon lands across Canada. Indigenous objection was not confined to the Lubicon Cree, since protesters were present along the relay route in every province except Prince Edward Island. These tactics and critiques reemerged in 2010 at the Vancouver Winter Olympics. The Winter Games were met with massive protests locally and internationally. In October 2007, 1,500 Indigenous delegates at the Intercontinental Indigenous Gathering in Sonora, Mexico, passed a resolution saying, "We reject the 2010 Winter Olympics on sacred and stolen territory of Turtle Island, Vancouver, Canada." This launched a global boycott of the 2010 Games, with protests rallying under the slogan, "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land." The 2010 Winter Games were also criticized for being held in a city where so many people live in desperate social conditions, particularly in Vancouver's downtown east side, which at the time of the Vancouver Games bid was home to the largest off-reserve Aboriginal population in Vancouver. For years, Indigenous and settler anarchists organized against the Games. Actions and demonstrations were frequent, while anti-capitalist and anti-colonial graffiti was a common sight around the city. Unlike many summit protests, which often lacked an anti-racist and anti-colonial analysis, Indigenous sovereignty and decolonization was front and center during the Olympics. Indigenous people called upon their allies to help defend their territory against further colonization, which culminated in several days of action beginning on February 12th. At 8:30 a.m., hundreds of downtown Eastside residents, including Native warriors, anarchists, and other supporters, successfully blockaded the intersection of East Hastings and Canby Street. When police attempted to disperse the crowd by force, some stood their ground while others sat down in the middle of the intersection, refusing to comply with the police orders. Unable to clear the street, the police were forced to tell the Torch Relay to change its route and not travel down Hastings into the downtown east side. In East Vancouver, hundreds took the street and used barbed wire and boulders to block the Torch from coming through the neighborhood. Once word came in that the Torch was being rerouted, they moved up Commercial Drive to ensure that it would not get around them and up the drive. When torchbearer Carrie Serwetnik arrived, she was chased out of the neighborhood and had to be escorted into the back of a police cruiser with torch in hand. At 3 p.m., several thousand protesters, including 100 in Black Bloc, assembled at the epicenter of the Olympic Circus. Led by Indigenous elders, they marched from the Vancouver Art Gallery to disrupt the opening ceremonies of the 2010 Olympics at BC Place. The participants respected the call for this to be an all-ages family-friendly demo. However, family-friendly did not mean imposed pacifism. In response to a request for people to move to the front in order to protect Indigenous elders from police harassment, the Black Bloc and Native warriors faced off with the police. The Black Bloc contingent was organized, closing ranks and holding police at bay. Members confiscated officers' hats, vests, and flashlights, while tossing orange pylons, tires, and other debris their way. Early the next morning, 400 anarchists arrived bright and early at Thornton Park for the heart attack demonstration, calling for a diversity of tactics to, quote, clog the arteries of capitalism. The march was intended to cause mayhem and attack the corporate heart of downtown Vancouver. The march immediately took over both directions of Main Street and moved north towards East Hastings. People started dragging everything that wasn't bolted down into the streets in order to block police vehicles from following in their wake. Some began spray-painting buses and attacking luxury cars. Demonstrators were received with popular support and many downtown Eastside residents joined in. A dumpster was dragged out of an alley, spray-painted and overturned in the middle of the street as police nervously looked on. Officers kept their distance from the unruly crowd, which was now smashing parking meters, defacing billboards, and continuing to obstruct intersections with newspaper boxes. The march turned on Georgia Street and made its way closer to the Olympic celebration zone. This hub of capitalism featured many flagship stores of Olympic sponsors and was the central gathering point for Olympic tourists and enthusiasts. The march made it 14 blocks down Georgia Street, wreaking havoc upon the Olympic spectacle. As newspaper boxes continued to appear in the street, chairs, lumber, a ladder, and other instruments were seized from the surrounding area in order to escalate the conflict. People began to smash the windows of the Hudson's Bay Company's Olympic department store in front of thousands of shocked spectators. This attack occurred on the intersection of Granville and Georgia, the pulse of corporate Vancouver. As the march proceeded west towards the Lionsgate Bridge and the Western Bayshore Hotel, which housed the International Olympic Committee, police moved in and attempted to make arrests. Many dispersed at this point, but a group of approximately 100, including a festive marching band, were able to continue south, looping around to head west on Robson. Over an hour later, this group was surrounded and detained by riot cops. The police were eventually forced to release them by bystanders and supporters chanting, "Let them go." The heart attack demonstration quickly became headline news. Politicians, news pundits, and scared leftists all across Canada denouncing the acts of property destruction. Still, these 2 days of action helped broadcast the original message of anti-Olympics organizing loud and clear. Today, we'll be speaking to a friend and comrade who was around during the height of the opposition to the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. Do you want to just talk briefly about what it was like growing up in Vancouver in the time preceding the Olympics? So, I guess, late 90s, early 2000s?
I'd say in the late 90s, a little bit, but especially in the early 2000s, a massive construction boom began, independent of the Olympics or even the hype around the Olympics being on their way. It took a while before it actually started to drive up rents. It was initially just sort of like eating up unused space here and there, you know, so-called unused space, as I recall. You know, maybe they would take down like two or three houses and then put up like a condo development that could house like 30 people or whatever. I sort of came of age at that time period, and myself and a lot of my friends, like from then until now, kind of it was just natural that we got sucked into the construction industry. It's a very different, like, from, yeah, it's a very different situation from what, like, say I read about on the internet and hear about other places of what, like, say, like the so-called millennial generation went through, at least as far as employment is concerned, because employment in for most of my adult life, especially for like able-bodied dudes, but like in general in Vancouver and the surrounding area, hasn't really been a problem like it has for much of the millennial generation. Although I'm sure the gig economy and everything is starting to eat things up there now at this point. Yeah, as far as like clear, like big social events that like changed the social dynamic of the city, I think like obviously 1986, and then that pre-Olympics construction boom, and then eventually culminating in the Olympics themselves and the construction boom that happened afterwards, which looked different, or are the only things, but the one after the Olympics or around and after the Olympics looked a bit different in my mind from what we had seen before, because it just started to affect all the space in the city. By the time I left Vancouver a couple years ago, like 3 years ago, you could be in a neighborhood, say that you used to live in, I'm thinking of like one particular neighborhood, Mount Pleasant, right? And I remember I had lived there at some point, and I like had to pass by there on the bus for work sometime after living there. And then like 2 or 3 months later, I went by there to go postering or something, And the place, I almost felt lost. The place looked like completely different, and it was like several blocks that had changed like within a year that just made the place like totally unrecognizable. And this is common all over the city and throughout the suburbs as well. It's just like eating up all the space, turning it all into like either expensive rent or high priced real estate all over the entire city. So say for a person of my social position in Vancouver who was at a young age able to like kind of get in on the ground floor as like a worker in the construction industry, by now for a lot of people like me, like even for us who make a fairly high wage for a worker, most of us can't afford to live in and around the city, or we're paying like some ridiculous amount of our income just to live in and around the city. So we did well in terms of employment, but some of the other processes of these new phases of capitalism have begun to affect us now. Mm-hmm. And that's just, I don't know, I'm just speaking for someone from my social position.
The first thing that comes to my mind when I think of Vancouver is the housing market. You know, it's one of the most expensive, overinflated places to live in the world. And it has been for quite some time. As far as I'm aware, like, during the time that we're talking about when you were growing up, there were quite a few struggles for housing. There were squats and occupations and dozens of organizations that involved themselves pretty heavily in the instability of housing in the area. Were you aware of any of these things when you were growing up? Like, was there an idea in the back of your head that like, man, I live in this really weird and messed up place where like a lot of people are struggling just to pay rent or getting displaced from their neighborhoods at a faster and faster rate?
I'm aware now that I've been politicized for quite some time that these things were going on, but like growing up, it, even though I have, say, like fairly lefty parents, mm-hmm. And I grew up in a housing co-op, like a particular like form of social housing, I wasn't so aware of a lot of the struggles until after I became politicized. Mm-hmm. I maybe have vague recollections of Francis Street, but like nothing I can even really speak to. I was very young at the time. The Woodward squat, I remember. The way I remember like a struggle, say like the Woodward squat, coming into my understanding of the world was just like through like the media spectacle around it.
Yeah.
The thing about Vancouver is that it's not like Montreal, say, where you have like a population that's been here for hundreds of years and they have a history and there was like struggles here, you know, throughout the 60s and 70s, and many of the same people involved in the struggles, if they aren't dead now, still live in the city in and around Montreal. Vancouver has had a very transient population for a long time. It's a much younger place. It's gone through many waves of like boom and development and everything, and like social and cultural shifts and everything. So it's a weird thing to say, but like people in Vancouver don't really have like a sense of like, there's no like activist tradition. There are traditions of struggle, but they've been sort of like moved over so many times by different waves of like social changes and cultural changes and whatnot. The idea that like, oh, like rent's starting to go up, this is a problem, we need to struggle to do something about it. You know, we need to like hold on to something that we have, or we need to fight for something that we need. It isn't really there in the population.
So Vancouver was announced as the host of the 2010 Winter Olympics in 2004, a whole 6 years before the games were actually set to begin. When this happened, did you have a political understanding of what this meant, or do you remember what people around you thought? Was there any discontent, or were people just generally stoked about the whole thing?
It was a mixed bag. Mm-hmm. I think like early on, a lot of people thought it was dumb.
Yeah.
Or just didn't care. There was a plebiscite within the city of Vancouver itself, whether or not to host the Olympics, and people voted no, really? But they went ahead and did it anyway. Vancouver is kind of like the middle of nowhere. culturally, geographically, and whatnot. Like, yeah, it's like a big city and everything, but like, it's separated by the American border from like Seattle and the American West Coast, and it's separated by the Rocky Mountains and like a vast territory from any other like major Canadian city. I think in my mind at the beginning thought like, oh, the Olympics are going to happen. That means it's like Vancouver is going to be like a place, you know, that people will know about now, and having like some like weird, maybe a sense of pride or something stupid about that. But yeah, that was, I think that was, to the extent that people like thought it was a good thing, that was where people were coming from. And as you got closer to the Olympics, there was more and more people who kind of like dug their heels in on that kind of position and didn't really like broader social, you know, most like most people, those of us that grew up in the neoliberal sort of generation, or you know, those of us who like grew up since the early 80s or whatever, we don't really have like a, we've been kind of socialized or taught not to think about social questions in like a broad and nuanced kind of way. Like in a way that, say, like probably the boomer generation, it was a bit different, you know, like people just kind of follow the hype and the spectacle. Not that they haven't done that for a long time, but they much more so now than ever.
How did your opinion on the Olympics change when you became politicized over the years?
Well, actually, I had already been somewhat politicized. I just wasn't active politically.
Yeah.
By the time the Olympics were a thing, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, I think I got more and more sold on the idea of like fighting the Olympics, mainly based on the fact that it was just like a point of social tension, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing. Any point of social tension is a good thing. Like, there was the whole, like, no Olympics on stolen native land. That was, like, initially, like, a very small, that was, like, only, like, a couple people, you know, really talking about that. A lot of, like, the opposition to the Olympics initially, had been, like, citizen groups and whatnot. Or, like, oh, you know, you didn't listen to us on the plebiscites. And we didn't want the Olympics. And it's, you know, irresponsible public spending and blah, 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 and all that sort of stuff. And I think when I heard the No Olympics on Stolen Native Land thing, I think that, like a lot of people probably since then, that made me sort of question the whole notion of Canada and whatnot. Mm-hmm. It affected me in, like, a broader contextual kind of way. I think I also initially saw that, like, you know, it isn't just the Olympics. It's, like, Canada is on stolen native land. It's, like, the whole of the capitalist social relations are on stolen native land. Mm-hmm. And I think I picked up on that pretty fast.
I think it's interesting how the Olympic Resistance Network, which was, I guess, like, the biggest above-ground oppositional body to the Olympics at the time, how they used the Olympics as a springboard to talk about colonialism and land theft and capitalism and poverty. It almost didn't seem like stopping the Olympics was the main goal. Rather, it was secondary to all these other things that people had been involved in for years and years and years. I guess my question is, when people started organizing against the Olympics, was the plan always to try to stop the games themselves? Or was the media spectacle surrounding the Olympics used as a way to bring these things out into the public?
Yeah, I'd say it was both. Mm-hmm. I'd say there was a lot of us, like, including myself at certain times, that had like crazy ideas about, oh yeah, like so many people are going to show up, like Zapatistas are going to show up and the Mohawk Warriors are going to show up and it's going to be crazy. Yeah. We're going to stop the Olympics. You know, I had like crazy ideas in my head at certain points because it was like a long time. You know, it was maybe 3-4 years before the Olympics happened that like the resistance really started to ramp up. And then eventually, like, I think there was some anarchist comrades not involved with the Olympic Resistance Network. The Olympic Resistance Network, is a good thing to bring up. It had like a lot of different people from a lot of different political persuasions in it that were kind of like united at like kind of like attacking all the different manifestations of the Olympics and to like sort of like counter the Olympic spectacle in various ways. But there were other people involved in things that weren't involved with the Olympic Resistance Network. Mm-hmm. Among those were like some crews of anarchists that didn't want to have to do with that they didn't really agree with kind of like the activist style of the Olympic Resistance Network, and had kind of the concept of like, well, really what you need to do is like fight the the effects of the Olympics, and not necessarily, like, you're not going to be able to stop the Olympics. Like, what is this, like, Olympic Resistance Network? We need to fight the effects of the Olympics. But, of course, activist hype and just, like, and whatever, activist hype and whatnot kind of meant that they were a bit isolated in that view. And I think in some ways, had a bit of a naive way of going about it. Like, didn't respect the fact that, like, symbols are important for people. It's like the same reason that the Olympics as a symbol is beneficial to capitalism and the narrative of capitalism and all the property development around it, and nationalism and whatnot. The resistance to the Olympics as, like, a symbol is also an important thing. And I think a lot of that factored into this. It's not necessarily a dichotomy of the spectacle and the symbol versus the real, like, nitty-gritty, like, what's actually happening on the ground.
Around the time of the Olympics, what were some other projects that anarchists in Vancouver were involved in?
There was some efforts at, like, supporting various strikes that were going on, such as city workers and whatnot. Mm-hmm. Solidarity efforts to pickets and... Well, there was also just kind of, like... support to indigenous struggles like Shudika, which, like, in some ways was kind of an anti-Olympic struggle again. Like, a lot of these things, they kind of, except for the city workers strike perhaps, kind of, like, factored into anti-Olympic resistance. There was the oldest social housing projects in Vancouver got evicted and demolished. And there was, like, various groups, like activist groups and whatnot, that tried to extend solidarity to them, including anarchists who were just like, if you guys want to squat, we'll support you and maybe squat with you, you know, if you guys want to refuse to leave. Because that's going off of the Francis Street example, that's mm-hmm. one of the more likely ways to be able to pull off an actual squat struggle in Vancouver, is to, like, if you're being evicted for a redevelopment or tearing down of a building, to just kind of, like, refuse to leave. Yeah, so they're the people, anarchists went and extended solidarity to the people. It was called Little Mountain Housing Co-op. People went and extended solidarity to them, and went to like a, either called a meeting or went to a meeting of them and, like, made the proposal of squatting. And, like, most of the people kind of were, they never, you know, like, people don't live in freaking England or something where there's, like, a tradition of squatting. So they were kind of like, I don't know, okay, that's an interesting idea, I don't know. And then next thing you know, like, professional activists come along and, like, oh, you know, we'll get this local NDP candidate to lobby for you, this, that, the other. And that seems a lot more official and everything, and people don't really want to have to get their hands dirty, so they'll kind of let the system take care of itself. And then eventually they all got evicted and lost their houses. There's maybe one building left there. But yeah, it wasn't just the anarchists versus the activists. There was also a lot of anarchists, including myself, who were involved with some of the more activist-y stuff, including the Olympic Resistance Network and the Anti-Poverty Committee, but at the same time, like, understood the critiques of activism, but yeah. I was just, like, a gung-ho young person that just wanted to, like, be doing stuff all the time.
Anti-Olympic organizing was taken up by anarchists, environmentalists, indigenous people, and anti-poverty activists, to name a few. In your opinion, was there much cohesion between these groups, or did people generally stick to themselves?
I think in some ways, the Olympic Resistance Network became a little bit like a activist all-stars group of, like, various, you know, like a couple people from Known as Illegal, a bunch of people from Anti-Poverty Committee, like a couple indigenous radicals, a couple old anti-globalization people, some of the people who were part of the original, like, citizens groups opposing the Olympics and whatnot. But yeah, there was, like, around, like, certain demonstrations or certain things that happened, like, they were able to all kind of bring out the different variety of people that would have come exclusively only to these single issue based kind of demos. Mm-hmm. So there was it was dispersed. But there was, like, yeah, that, like, kind of activist all-stars sort of thing going on that, like, kind of made the Olympic resistance, like, the thing to do mm-hmm. for, like, at least a couple years before the Olympics. Yeah.
So the band councils of the four local Coast Salish nations actually signed a protocol in 2004 approving the Olympics, saying that they have their blessing that the Olympic Committee should host the Games in Vancouver, even though a lot of First Nations people generally oppose the Games. Do you remember any tension between tribal governments and individuals who opposed the Olympics, and was identity politics ever mobilized in support of them, citing, you know, the four host First Nations as proof that, quote unquote, Indigenous people supported them?
Yeah, occasionally. From what I saw, that did happen occasionally. Times where I remember it most often, or that I remember it most clearly, were like during the Olympics itself. Mm-hmm. And from the mainstream, it was kind of like a media delegitimization line against the anti-Olympics protests. Like, oh, this is whatever. Oh, like the natives or the First Nations are actually into it, or like a lot of native people in Vancouver are not Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, Musqueam, etc. And so we're a little bit less like bound by that decision of certain like band council politicians. We're a little bit less affected by those kind of internal politics, and we're going to be negatively affected by the Olympics in various ways. And we're obviously super down with the anti-Olympics resistance. Maybe didn't even necessarily get involved much. Mm-hmm. Maybe went to a couple demos when the Olympics happened, but... Well, yeah, actually, you know, and I guess another thing is, I think occasionally people tried to make the argument that, like, oh, the native people who are calling for the opposition to the Olympics, like, this isn't their territory, mm-hmm. so how can they be calling for people to come? That was an argument it worked a little bit. There were even some like anarchists and radicals who were pushing that out of guilt. Hmm. Oh yeah, we should fight the Olympics, but like we're just as bad as the colonizers for asking people to come for a convergence onto stolen land. It's like, well, so yeah, in some ways, I guess it was used like that. But it's like a funny kind of identity politics, you know what I mean? So when you ask like, oh, was identity politics used? I guess in a way, but it was kind of weird. It was more about like confusion about like exactly what colonization is, and like exactly who can call for people to come, and like what does a call look like. And
were there any concerns about surveillance at the time, either in organizing circles or in the mainstream? I know the RCMP allotted, I think, $900 million for the creation of an integrated security unit, groups of special cops that are formed in the run-up to big events in Canada. There were also about 1,000 security cameras installed in the city in the lead-up to the Olympics. Yeah, I guess, were there any concerns about what this could mean for people organizing against the Olympics, or how this might change the social landscape of the city?
It could be different now with like AI and technology, and everybody starting to like get used to the idea that like Facebook is watching them, and mm-hmm. Google's like listening to their conversations to decide what to sell them. Like at the time, like a lot of the concerns around surveillance, definitely in the mainstream, like, you know, when you tried to make like an activist campaign or a media campaign out of it or something, like, oh, this is really bad, all the security spending and all these security cameras. At the time, a lot of people just didn't really care. Like, you sort of like, kind of like, I'm doing nothing wrong problem. Or within activist groups, yeah, it definitely like at times it had a chilling effect, because you had cops like knocking on people's doors and knocking on people's parents' doors, or coming to people's jobs, coming to people's schools, and kind of just sort of like letting people know, oh, we're watching you, basically. Mm-hmm. But under the guise of, oh, we're just coming to interview you and ask you some questions.
Yeah.
There were times when that put a bit of a chill on things. There was like definitely, I would say, a number of undercovers that I knew during the Olympics, or I'm pretty confident were. There was only maybe one or two of them that were ever confirmed to actually be undercovers by the end through like FOI requests. Yeah, there was some concern, but I think we ended up not really getting... I don't know exactly for what reason, if our just security culture was just so awesome, or if the undercovers ended up deciding not to do their job very well or something. But it ended up not really screwing a lot of people over. There was like a wave of attacks from like 2006 until the Olympics, mm-hmm. like against the Olympics, that were going on in secret. And yeah, I think probably like some, there was probably a good enough security culture that, like, the undercovers who were maybe trying to focus on that weren't able to get to it. And then when it came to the actual Olympics, a lot of the whatever destruction did happen, it was, like, very spontaneous. Mm-hmm. Whereas that's, like, a very different story, say, from the G20, when people, like, actually came up with, like, lists of targets. Yeah, and, yeah, you know, made a plan about, like, specific... Like, the plan for the heart attack demonstration was actually to just make it across downtown with no specific idea that necessarily things were going to be destroyed, mm-hmm. but just to sort of quote-unquote disrupt and maybe make it to the Lionsgate Bridge to shut down the bridge for the day, yeah. or for the morning. And then, you know, spontaneously things happened. So it was kind of hard for undercovers to really, like, help the cops, help the other cops or whoever to, like, build a case in spontaneous actions like that.
You mentioned the heart attack demo. Can you speak about the days of action that happened? I think the opening day of the Olympics was February 12th and the demo was the next day.
Wow, my memory is foggy. So February 12th, I believe. Yeah, that's right. February 12th was the opening ceremonies. There was a mass demonstration from the art gallery with a large black block. There was a lot of weird, like, coalition politicking around where the black block was going to be. Anarchists kind of had to, like, legitimize ourselves within these larger groups, within a political culture that wasn't so used to, like, you know, it's not like Europe again, you know, where people are used to that type of activity. Anarchists kind of had to legitimize our presence through saying, oh, well, the Black Bloc is going to, like, protect the... We want to have the native elders at the front representing this large mass mobilization because it's, like, you know, it's no Olympics and still on native land and whatnot. And we don't want it to be drowned out by white activist groups or whatnot, which is legit. But then anarchists kind of were able to legitimize themselves within it by saying, okay, well, we'll be at the front to, like, protect the elders from the cops or from repression or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there was a large black block that day at the front of the march. It culminated in, like, a little, like, standoff, like, exchanging swear words with the cops in front of BC Place. Attempts to, like, push through the cop line, but not really able to do it. I think there was a similar kind of incident. Well, maybe not a similar kind of incident, but, like, it had a similar kind of dynamic to, like, I think it was, like, the NATO meeting in Chicago some years later, where you had, like, a bunch of anarchists just kind of, like, being part of, like, a media spectacle, like, facing off against the cops, mm-hmm. when they would have done a lot better to go a completely different direction and to do different things. So there was a lot of people that had, like, a frustration that what happened in the heart attack demo didn't happen during the Olympic ceremonies first. We definitely had the power to do that day. But yeah, the efforts kind of got focused on just, like, facing off with the cops in a really ineffectual kind of way. Maybe people had an idea that somehow we were going to storm BC Place and disrupt the ceremonies, but definitely wasn't going to happen. Then, on the second day, the beginning of the day, it was called the heart attack demonstration, meaning that you were going to clog the arteries of capitalism, meaning the streets, and shut down the Olympics on the first day, or at least create some type of mayhem on the first day. That started from Thornton Park in Chinatown and marched through the downtown east side, and then kind of sort of half-assed kicked off as soon as we left the downtown east side and got into the downtown core. Trash cans started getting thrown out in the street. Cars started getting vandalized, and then a few shop windows were smashed, most notably at the Hudson's Bay Company. Then I think the Vancouver, like, crowd control unit maybe we wanted to hold off on mobilizing in case we weren't actually going to do anything, kind of like the night before, because they wanted to keep up the appearance of Vancouver being, like, a good tourist city where... Yeah. You know, police repression doesn't happen and whatnot. Showed up in vans to stop us from making it towards the Lionsgate Bridge somewhere along West Georgia. Formed a line, there was a little tussle, and the black block got split up a little bit, and then people decided to disperse. Mm-hmm. And that was it. Mm-hmm. So there was a little bit of property destruction, and it was good. Like I was saying, like, the symbol of resistance to the Olympics, it, like, showed that people were serious. There were definitely a number of people that I talked with in the years after the Olympics who kind of had been cynical about organizing in Vancouver for a long time, but then kind of like saw what happened in the heart attack demo and said, oh, so people are serious then. You know, it isn't just like this like white civil citizen sort of posture. And then I think a lot of efforts, as I recall, got focused on there was a tent city that got set up early on in the Olympics on West Hastings across the street from Save On Meats. A lot of efforts went to like supporting the tent city, and it became kind of like a social space for people to gather in. Like anarchists, so a crew of anarchists had like an anarchist social space, 12th and Clark in East Vancouver. There was maybe a couple, one or two events during the Olympics, maybe some like discussions about the Olympics and what happened and whatnot there, but like the tent city served really as like a hub for resistance to the Olympics, for people to plug in, for people to see what was going on, for people to have conversations about what was happening. People spent a lot of time there and it was cool, you know, it was like downtown Eastside, and that continued until the last day. On the last day there was like I remember it was really tense because people were, because the Team Canada had won the gold medal on the last day of the Olympics, and there was a lot of rowdy people downtown, and you know, some anarchists were hoping it would like kick off in like a Vancouver Canucks riot type of situation, but it didn't. If anything, it was kind of just like a drunken nationalist like lovin'. I definitely had fears that there was going to be like drunken rednecks coming down to the tent city to come and fuck shit up. So there was like a presence there on the last day, and people like barricaded the road. We shut down Hastings for a bit in the evening. That was kind of cool. There was like a little fire lit in the middle of the street, and there was like a funny incident where like the cops had like negotiations with the people at the tent city, and like people were joking about wanting to make these demands of like having like city councilors make breakfast for us and all this shit, or we weren't gonna take down the tent city and stuff. But eventually they sent in the riot squad in the middle of the night when the numbers had dwindled and people just sort of like got off the road and whatnot. There was a bunch of people after the heart attack demonstration who suddenly like distanced themselves or like had some type of critiques and like stated them publicly in the media, trying to like become like the legitimate protesters or whatnot. Mostly like Trotskyists and social democrats. Including one person who was involved with the Olympic Resistance Network before. I don't know if they had like colleagues harassing them because they're a doctor. And they decided to publicly denounce the heart attack demonstration. Obviously what happens in these situations, the media jumps on that and they say, oh, see, there are legitimate protesters, these are the guys you listen to and whatnot. And that happened. Somebody who is now a pretty important member of the BC government, his name is David Eby, who had previously been like an anti-poverty lawyer who actually supported some radicals in like court cases here and there, came out publicly against the Olympics, or not against the Olympics, sorry, came out publicly against the heart attack demonstration, the Black Bloc, and people smashing shit up, with a lot of really absurd critiques. And there was a public event where he got pied. And there was, like, these three people trying to defend this, like, anti-Black Bloc position. And it was really hilarious. They just got heckled the whole night. And then there was this, like, social democrat activist superstar douchebag, Derek O'Keefe, who had a public debate with Harsha Walia about that. I think it was at the time a pretty famous debate. I'm sure you can find it on YouTube. There was a zine made out of the position. It was like a pretty good like diversity of tactics versus opposition to diversity of tactics debate. I think at the time, for me, it was politically important because I had remembered back in 2004, there was like the resistance to the Well, and prior to that, like in 2004, and then prior to that, when the BC Liberals got elected and started escalating like neoliberal restructuring in the city, and then in 2004 when the Iraq War happened, there was like, I remember wanting to get involved in stuff. Like, I didn't identify as an anarchist yet, but wanting to get involved in stuff, and the political environment just being so suffocated by these careerist commies and social democrats and like NDP people that like nothing really happened and everything was really not inspiring. And so it was really nice to see like a large mobilization and like a large like spectacular kind of event that wasn't able to be kind of snuffed out by these wet blankets and like the people. And it like it kind of showed like a change in the possibilities for social movements like in Vancouver and I think like in Canada too. So that was really exciting at the time.
I guess there is one last thing. One last question. In your opinion, do you think the Olympics ramped up the deterioration of the quality of life in Vancouver, or was this inevitable anyway? Do you think stopping the Olympics or, you know, derailing it to a larger extent would have made a difference in how the social climate and the cost of living have changed since then?
I think I think the Olympics sped up these processes, but really what we're dealing with in Vancouver, and actually in every large freaking city in a Western country in the world, is like this is just like a phase of capitalism that we're in, where capitalism doesn't have anywhere to reinvest itself, and so it creates these construction booms and property development bubbles. That is like sort of the way it's keeping itself going right now, and I think in order to, on a local level, I mean, if you could do it like on a mass scale, you would really be talking about like a serious challenge to the capitalist system, like a serious threat to capitalism, like a very revolutionary kind of situation if you could challenge that everywhere. Mm-hmm. But like just on a local level in a particular place, I think what you would need is like a tradition of social struggle and like infrastructure and just like an uncontrollable kind of population and like and social movements and whatnot that I don't think Vancouver really could had the time to get going for itself. Mm-hmm. In order to stop what was happening. I feel like it's also kind of like a chicken or an egg thing. Like, do the social movements produce like the really spectacular events, or do the spectacular events really produce the social movements? I think it's kind of whatever. It kind of works both ways. I think what we did do with the Olympics definitely contributed to a situation for at least a year or two afterwards, and for a year or two before, where social movements were more interesting than they had been in quite some time for Vancouver, because there was that energy around the Olympics and a lot of hype, and then people coming from out of town, and there just being like a more interesting climate for struggle. But at the same time, like, we were only going to be so effective without there being like already a place for that struggle to be coming from. Having stopped the games, actually stopped the games, it would have had to have happened in a completely different context. Yeah. And in which case you would be talking about a very different context for like the struggle against this process of capitalism and not just the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And I think so, like, that the way that the Olympics sped things up was intense. It's like worth mentioning. It wasn't just that, oh, it's like this phase of capitalism and there was nothing we could do about it, and the Olympics didn't really matter in the grand scheme of things or something. But no, like, I think it definitely sped up whatever was going to happen in Vancouver. if like right after the Olympics, there was still like a fairly large for the size of the city and like the type of city it is, anarchist presence in Vancouver. With a lot of different projects going on, and it really felt like things were going somewhere. Mm-hmm. But then I think what kind of like what happened to the anarchist scene in Vancouver kind of happened to like the population in general in Vancouver. Yeah. Like no one could just afford to live there, and it just kind of like killed everything. Mm-hmm. Culturally and whatnot. And it was like by 2012 basically, like it was over. And it just got worse and worse as the years went on. And that's like a pretty short span of time. I think some of the success of the Olympics, in terms of like showing like how a fairly radical position like this is stolen native land, which at the time was like quite a radical position. Mm. Could like still produce like a fairly large mobilization. Mm-hmm. I think that really brought to the mainstream the idea that like a lot of what you see happening now, where it's pretty mainstream to like at least within like activist circles or whatever to like know what territory you're on and whatnot. So I think like the resistance to the Olympics like did have kind of a lasting effect, even if that lasting effect was like sort of a form of recuperation. Mm-hmm. That like even the city of Vancouver acknowledges it's on stolen land but continues to like be a capitalist city on stolen land. Just it was sort of like it was part of like the what came with like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Mm-hmm. And whatnot after the apology, the Harper apology.
Yeah.
But I think the resistance to the Olympics like really kind of made that a thing. Mm-hmm. Which is like perhaps a kind of success. It was like an effect of some of things that happened, and that I'd say that's it's like a good thing. Mm-hmm. In a way, it comes with its own set of problems, like as any recuperation does. But it's probably better that people are familiar with the idea that like the genocide wasn't complete, and that and as well that the genocide actually happened.
First of all, I got no immigration papers. The government, you know they're racist. The police, you know they hate us. They love to beat us up, lock us down and chase us. So Mr. Colonizer, sorry to disappoint, but you won't bring about our demise. It seems your oppressive tactics didn't surmise to put out the spark and the fire in our eyes. You see, resistance got freedom on the mind and coals in spines to keep goals in line. And it's by your design that the poor ain't fine while the rich gallivant and wine and dine. But now we uprising, stopping their gentrifying and forced installation of pipelines. And when the clock strikes nine, some will be obedient working slaves, but some will leave it all behind and blockade highways, shut down banks while government ranks cooperate against the greater good, led by pig cops in riot gear. Seems they're ready, so we maybe should start a riot here. Put a monkey wrench in their gears, allow the stench of their fears to roam and roam. We bad to the bone, our badness has grown in proportion to the numbers of their flying killer drones. Land is not owned, it's respected, served and protected, but these Uncle Tom punks is on some next shit. Them pink face plantation owning sacks and evil flesh will soon face emancipated peace, flying freedom crest. Yes, yes, yes. I said them pink-faced plantation-owning sacks of evil flesh will soon face emancipated peeps.
It's like I'm fighting for freedom.
Yeah.
It's like I'm fighting for freedom.
Yeah. Woo.
It's like I'm fighting for freedom. You've been listening to From Embers on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston. Tune in here every Wednesday at 8 p.m., or you can listen to the podcast version online by searching for From Embers wherever you get your podcasts. Email us if you have any questions or want to get in touch at fromembers@riseup.net. Thanks for listening.
we don't stand who will on earth. The wind comes in four corners, four directions, four colors. And death rides on four horsemen. A black snake with some black tanks. How much money do these companies need to make? They could drop their product, but they wanna save a buck. Already extracted billions, when is enough enough? I used to be in the oil fields, getting paid. But I quit, cause oil water I can't drink. Look down and see Kamimi Ladai in the mud. I looked up and told myself that enough's enough. Money does not own my soul, living comfortable. It's not in my plans, my hands in the sand. Some things worth more than gold. Some things they can't be sold. Some things can't be replaced. She is your mother, the fresh water is her veins. What is going on? Have we all lost our minds? Every human needs clean water to survive. Since 1492, 500 years and counting, surviving the genocide they call colonizing my turtle island. What is a fossil fuel? Continued destruction, nothing new. Living a system, taking our children, shipping their feelings till nothing's true. I had that money in front of me, but I left it. Cause oil money's dirty if my mother gets disrespected. We're disconnected, these times are hectic and feeling heavy. But still we love all living beings and suffer for the many. We are peaceful people, that's why we walk with prayer. And if that wasn't true, we wouldn't be standing.
The Kingston Community House for Self-Reliance, widely known as 99 York, has for 30 years been providing a central, low-cost meeting space for groups that allow like-minded people to come together to learn from one another, to share resources and trade skills. The goal of this house is to act as an integral part of the neighborhood in which it is located. On a typical evening, an autism caregiver relief group will be at 99 York, together with a 12-step organization and a transgendered support group, while a social justice and homeschooling group may be booked in the following day. The community house is also available for less official functions, such as barbecues, birthday and office parties, and other social gatherings. We are proud to also serve the Queens community. For more information, visit 99 York Street in Kingston. Go to www.99york.org, email info@99york.org, or call 613-542-1136.
Love podcasts? Want to try your hand at podcasting? Why not make your mark and join CFRC's podcast network? Visit podcast.cfrc.ca, check out the great podcasts already produced right here at CFRC, and find out how you too can have your very own podcast.